Greetings, Sun Sounds listeners, and welcome to the Philosopher Program. This is your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. Well, we still have not received the latest issue of Science of Mind. I do hope we receive it soon so I can share it with you, at least for part of the month. But for now, I will share a couple of selections from the June issue. What's next? Each morning we're born again. Of yesterday nothing remains. What's left began today. Ansem Holo, Corvus. You are as young as your faith, as old as your fear, as young as your hope, as old as your despair. In the central place of every heart there is a recording chamber. So long as it receives messages of beauty, cheer, and courage, so long are you young. Ernest Holmes, Help for Today, page 81.4-82.2. Our year is at the halfway point. Has the year been what you hoped it would be? Each new year, so many of us begin with lofty resolutions without being resolute in achieving them. For all kinds of reasons, including anxiety and trauma, we do not follow through. Let's get real for a moment. If we continue to engage in performative science of mind without addressing real-world traumas and suffering, we're no different from others who pontificate and posture while avoiding action. If we were able to change the world with that approach, it would have happened already. We have yet to reach the tipping point Holmes referred to when he said, "You find me 1,000 people in the world who know what religious science is and use it and live it as it is, and I'll myself live to see a new world, a new heaven, and a new earth here." And this is our invitation today. Forget about what we did not do yesterday or what we could have or should have done in the past. The point of power and transformation is right here and right now. Are you willing to commit to knowing, practicing, and living this new thought liberation theology in relevant and applicable ways? Are we ready to actively heal our addictions, traumas, fears, anxieties, acts of violence, corruption, greed, and more, all of which stem from a consciousness of separation? Affirmation. In each moment, I choose to do what is mine to do. I put actions to my words, and I am a catalyst for lasting healing and evolution. And from the Daily Word, published by Unity, Possibilities. I open my mind to limitless possibilities. There are limits to what my mind can imagine. I may find a challenge too big to overcome or too complex to work through. In the past, I might have avoided such challenges, but today, I turn within for guidance. Within my inner sanctuary, I find infinite possibilities. For God, Spirit, the universe, nothing is or ever could be impossible. As a spiritual being, I open my mind so these possibilities can enter my imagination. With spiritual sight, I begin to apprehend what is possible. I emerge from my prayer time filled with inspiration and clarity, ready to take the steps necessary to make my vision a reality. I return again and again to the limitless field of infinite potential, where I can claim divine ideas and know the presence and power of God, of Spirit, of the universe, is in and through all things. Joy. God's joy is my joy forever. Messages about the importance of being happy seem to be everywhere, but how can I be happy when personal challenges or worldly matters weigh me down? Remembering my spiritual identity, I do not despair when happiness seems beyond my reach. In those moments, I turn to joy. Happiness may be fleeting, but joy is divine, a part of God, Spirit, the universe, and a part of me. Joy is deep and unwavering, unaffected by what is happening in my life or in the world. I don't have to seek it. I need only claim it. My joy is anchored in my faith that God, Spirit, the universe, is my source and my guide, always present in every situation, however difficult. I appreciate moments of happiness, but my steadfast joy in God, in Spirit, in the universe, sustains me. And from Mark Nepos, The Book of Awakening, Having the Life You Want by Being Present to the Life You Have, The Heart's Blossom. Courage is the heart's blossom. All courage is threshold crossing. Often there is a choice to enter the burning building or not, to speak the truth or not, to stand before oneself without illusion or not. But there's another sort of courage we're talking about here, the kind when afterward the courageous are puzzled to be singled out as brave. They often say, "I had no choice. I had to run in that building for that child, or I had to quit my job, or I would have died." Despite all consequence, there is an inevitable honoring of what is true. And at this deep level of inner voice, it is not a summoning of will, but a following of true knowing. My own life is a trail of such following. Time and again I've heard deep callings that felt inevitable and which I could have ignored, but only at great risk of something essential perishing. It was this honoring of what is true that guided me through my cancer experience, saying no to brain surgery and yes to rib surgery, saying yes to chemo and no to chemo. Each decision appeared both courageous and illogical to my doctors. Since then, I have been called heroic for surviving, which is like championing an eagle for finding its nest, and I've been condemned as selfish for seeking the truth, which is like blaming a turtle for finding the deep. Courage of this sort is the result of being authentic. It is available to all, and its reward, far more than respect, is the opening of joy. Meditate on a decision that you're struggling with. Rather than focusing on your fear of what might or might not happen, try opening to what feels true. Without strategizing or imagining the consequences of honoring what feels true, simply let the truth as you know it rise within you. As you move through your day, let what is true fill you, even if you don't quite understand it. We return to the June Science of Mind Guide for Spiritual Living and Reverend Dr. Sonny Cantrell Smith's monthly column. It's a little longer and a little different than usual. Sacred Activism, the Decline of Spirituality in America. America has been a place where faith and moral values provided strength and guidance. But today, spirituality is fading, and with it the sense of shared purpose that once held the country together. This loss is reflected in the actions of our current leaders, whose lack of integrity and vision weaken the nation and strain relationships with our allies. At the same time, the rise of Christian nationalism distorted the role of faith in public life, replacing true spiritual values with an exclusionary and divisive ideology. As America drifts from its core values, the effects are being felt at home and across the globe, reclaiming our commitment to justice and community. For generations, spirituality was a force for justice, shaping American life by calling people to care for one another, especially the most vulnerable. Faith communities, churches, synagogues, mosques, and other places of worship long stood at the forefront of movements for equality, dignity, and the common good. Yet over time, the focus on our collective well-being often was overshadowed by materialism and individualism. When compassion and shared responsibility give way to self-interest, the most marginalized suffer the most. This shift deepened inequities and eroded trust in our institutions. But the call to justice remains. By reclaiming our spiritual foundation, we can rebuild a society rooted in fairness, dignity, and care for all, especially those who have been left out or left behind. The dangerous rise of Christian nationalism. While spirituality is in decline, Christian nationalism is on the rise, and it is rapidly reshaping the country's moral and political landscape. Unlike authentic faith, which promotes love, compassion, and inclusion, Christian nationalism seeks to merge religion with political power. This movement elevates one religious perspective above all others, undermining the nation's founding principles of religious freedom and diversity. Christian nationalism erodes the values of inclusion and respect for differences, pushing policies that exclude and marginalize people based on race, religion, gender, and identity. Instead of bringing people together, it fuels division and intolerance, distorting the essence of spirituality and turning faith into a political tool. A government without integrity. The current administration is a reflection of this spiritual decline and the growing influence of Christian nationalism, corruption, dishonesty, and policies that favor the powerful over everyday people have become standard practice. Instead of leading with integrity and vision, too many of our elected officials make decisions based on self-interest, weakening the trust of the people they take an oath to serve. From economic mismanagement to restricting civil freedoms, this administration fuels division and instability. When leaders lack a strong moral foundation, their actions lead to chaos. And that's exactly what we're seeing unfold. As America struggles with internal problems, it also has abandoned its longtime allies. Countries that once depended on U.S. leadership are now questioning our commitments. This creates a power vacuum, allowing authoritarian regimes to gain more influence while democratic values get pushed aside. Without strong global partnerships, the world becomes more dangerous. When America fails to support its allies, it weakens its own position and emboldens adversaries. This shift has serious consequences, from political instability to increased global conflict. The connection between spiritual and global decline. When a country loses its spiritual foundation, it also loses its sense of duty and leadership. America's struggles are not just political or economic. These struggles stem from a loss of core values. Without a strong moral compass, leaders make selfish decisions, and citizens lose sight of their nation's greater purpose. At the same time, the rise of Christian nationalism twists the role of faith, turning it into a tool of exclusion rather than unity. The true power of spirituality lies in its ability to connect, heal, and lift up people of all backgrounds. Without this, America remains adrift, struggling to uphold the values it once stood for. The effects are clear: a divided society, dishonest leadership, and a shrinking role on the world stage. If our country is to rebuild and regain its strength, it must reconnect with the spiritual and moral principles that once made it a source of hope and stability, principles that embrace diversity, inclusion, and justice. We turn now to the July-August 2025 issue of Spirituality and Health, a Unity publication, and an article by Karen Brailsford, an interview. This is Enlightened Perspectives, Anu Gupta on Breaking Bias. As a gay Indian-born immigrant with Buddhist, Christian, and Hindu roots, American lawyer, scientist, and meditation teacher Anu Gupta, J.D., knows all too well what it feels like to be othered. He's parlayed this firsthand knowledge into an impactful career focused on equity, healing, and belonging. The crux of his teachings? Bias is learned and can be unlearned through mindfulness and compassion. The founder of Be More, Beyond Equity Movement of Opportunities Rising for Everyone, with Anu, he has worked with more than 300 organizations and 100,000 professionals to dismantle bias. In Breaking Bias, Where Stereotypes and Prejudices Come From, and the Science-Backed Method to Unravel Them, with the foreword by the Dalai Lama, he suggests a process for dismantling homophobia, racism, classism, and sexism using his comprehensive toolkit. Here he shares with contributing editor Karen Brailsford his hopeful, more critical than ever, message. Or KB, what drew you to this subject? In 2014, I was working as a lawyer on issues of racial equity and gender equality. We have great policies on the books, but massive disparities still exist. Black teenagers were sentenced to 5 years in prison for petty infractions like low-level marijuana possession, while some lawyers at prestigious firms were doing controlled substances. I could tell that many judges and prosecutors were people of conscience and faith. They were doing amazing things in the community, but something prevented them from seeing the humanity of those the Bible calls the least of these. This is the nature of bias, particularly unconscious bias. I realized that unless we shift hearts and minds, we will not advance movement around justice, equality, and equity. I then took a break from my legal career to begin to identify the root causes of bias and discover how we unlearn it. In 2020, I was invited to be in conversation with Oprah Winfrey and Isabel Wilkerson around Isabel's book, Caste: The Origins of Our Discontent. Isabel said radical empathy is a solution to ending racism and the caste system. I was already training people in empathy and compassion tools, so a seed was planted. Then 4 months later, January 6th happened. I couldn't sleep for weeks. That's when I knew I had to write this book. KB, how do you break bias? It's shifting our consciousness from exclusion to inclusion, from hatred and separation to cooperation and unity. It's decolonizing our minds at the neural level. KB, bias nearly killed you. Can you recount that story for us? Experiences with racism, homophobia, and Islamophobia led me to want to take my life. In 2009, right before my 24th birthday, I found myself at the ledge of my 18th floor window about to jump. It was the beginning of my second year of law school. The first year had been intense, as it's supposed to be, but I'd come from an uplifting global and interactive environment. I'd gotten a master's degree in international development at Cambridge. There, I learned to think systemically, but also interpersonally and individually. In law school's pressure cooker environment, we weren't able to talk about bias. We were reading about criminal law, civil procedures, and civil rights, which are all about racism, sexism, and homophobia, but we couldn't share our personal experiences. And when you did share, you were gaslit. Someone would say namaste to me out of the blue or ask, "Where are you from?" I'd tell them and they'd go, "No, where are you really from?" Brooklyn was never sufficient. That's where the nature of othering really begins. When I said this was hurtful or annoying, I was told, "You're making too much of it." I'd already experienced quite a bit growing up in the United States. After 9/11, strangers on the street would call me Osama bin Laden. After college, I worked in South Korea and Myanmar, and I studied in the United Kingdom. In hindsight, I was running away from the United States because of experiences around bias. KB, what kept you from jumping? There was a moment of grace where instead of falling forward, I fell backward into my apartment. I called a friend who happened to be walking down my block and showed up in my apartment within a couple of minutes. The next day, I started my healing, breaking bias journey. I began therapy, and I returned to practices I'd been raised with, meditation and yoga. I'm a Kriya Yogi in the Self-Realization Fellowship, founded by Paramahansa Yogananda. My second summer in law school, I went to Taiwan, shaved my head, and joined the monastic order. I wanted to understand my mind, so I went deeper into understanding the nature of bias and the lies that I believed about myself. From a very young age, I was a seeker. When I was 5 years old in Delhi, there was a calendar on our wall with the words to the Gayatri Mantra. Something inside told me, "You need to memorize this." I went to college right after 9/11, and I wanted to understand why there was so much bigotry toward Muslims and why I, a non-Muslim, was on the receiving end of Islamophobia. This led me to return to India to study Islam. In it, I found the profound beauty, love, and compassion of Hinduism, Christianity, Buddhism, and many other wisdom traditions. After my suicide attempt, I went deep into Buddhism. But I also found community at New York's Middle Collegiate Church. The ministers preached a message of love, peace, and justice, calling all humans, regardless of sexuality or background, children of God. In this all-embracing environment, Jesus pulled me out of the closet. I began to see in Jesus the love I had for Krishna. It's a full circle. We're here to realize our fuller selves and the deep divinity within us. That's really important for any of us who are marginalized because of our identities. KB, how does your PRISM toolkit help people conquer bias? The science said implicit bias was the reason for disparities in racial equity and gender equality, and the research was showing that mindfulness tools mitigate them. That's where the idea behind the toolkit really began. PRISM is an acronym for perspective, taking, pro-social behavior, individuation, stereotype replacement, and mindfulness. You begin the practice with M and move up to P. Mindfulness is becoming aware of the concepts, thoughts, and stereotypes that arise in our minds along with the feelings of somatic experience. Then we move to stereotype replacement. When I think of a leader, I can think of Malala Yousafzai. When I think of a construction worker, I can think of a woman or a trans woman. Individuation is about investigation. After stereotypes arise and we replace them, we become curious as to where we learn them. If I'm talking to a black woman who wears locks, there are ideas in my mind about people with that hairstyle. With mindfulness, we notice those ideas and don't let them determine our words or actions toward people. Then we move to heart practices, pro-social behaviors, the active cultivation of compassion, empathy, joy, and altruism. In the Buddhist tradition, they're known as the divine abodes because these states are where God lives. For 2 years after I started my healing journey, I did loving kindness for myself. Finally, perspective taking is imagining what it's like to walk on the shoes of another. Actors do it really well. Creative agencies do it when they're thinking about their users and clients and create advertising and marketing. They're actively using empathy mapping. This is a capacity we all have, but there are skills we have to build. Science shows it takes as little as 18 days to build a new habit. KB, how empowering. But what about those who don't believe bias exists? I read a comment that said racism is real because people won't stop talking about it. It's important to acknowledge where we are. In Kriya Yoga, we meditate quite a bit, but we're not meditating just for peace of mind. We're meditating to gain insight. One insight is that whatever we're experiencing when it comes to bias is a consequence of many different causes and conditions. So in order for us to change the consequences, we want more equity, more kindness, more love in the world. We have to shift, pull out the weeds and plant new trees. Every spiritual teacher of the past has said, love is not only the destination, it is also the way. To get to that destination, we have to practice what we preach. KB, you write that people who are biased have this pull to be good. As someone who has come close to not being here, I extend grace to everyone. Hurt people hurt people. We are to remind them of the good they are doing. People are often manipulated by these bigger systems. Disinformation campaigns are very deliberate. They're manipulating people's biology. It's been shown that lies laced with hatred and anger spread 100 times faster than truth. This is what we're really up against. Algorithms are the dragons of our times. KB, your father's bias helped you understand bias. Mindfulness practice got me to that point. For a long time, I shut him down. I heard a lot of bigotry in my household. I asked him, why do you think all poor people are genetically deficient? I learned that a teacher whom he respected and who had encouraged him to become a doctor taught him bigoted views based in eugenics. It was important for me to understand he learned from this one person and that he had held on to those views not because of their veracity, but because of how he felt about that person. KB, you write that bias infects, implying that bias is a disease. Does one kind of bias infect more readily than another? Bias is a disease of the mind. Our consciousness has been infected with it, so it depends on the person. If someone who's been raised in an isolated, misogynistic environment is made to think that men are better than women and that genderqueer people don't exist, those become the habits of mind. It might be more difficult not to make those associations. I experience this when non-binary people ask me to use they, them pronouns. Because I had learned there were 2 pronouns, asking a third was difficult. But with practice, it became second nature. It's a willingness to grow and shift. KB, you're addressing people who know that bias exists and want to do something about it. You're not trying to convince anyone of anything. Margaret Mead had said that it takes a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens to change the world. I want to reach those individuals. After January 6th, I saw that a lot of people wanted to address bias but felt paralyzed. I asked myself, how can we bring this conversation to them in a compassionate, shame-free, trauma-informed way so that they can heal, grow, and invite others to this movement? It's about building that critical mass. I believe it's going to happen. It happened with gay marriage. We got to the tipping point. People said, if my mom, my auntie, and my neighbor are okay with it, then I'm listening to them. That's how consciousness shifts. When I started this work in 2014, people said, you're taking on the impossible. I thought, well, within 20 years, we connected the entire globe through Facebook and Instagram and other tools. If people can imagine colonizing Mars, why can't we imagine living on Earth without bias? It's about giving ourselves permission to imagine what's possible and going for it. 100 years ago, many people couldn't imagine a country that wasn't segregated or the end of colonialism. but a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens did. KB, at the end of Breaking Bias, you reveal your own biases. Can you elaborate? I spent the first 10 years of my life in India, which was still under the colonial hangover, where they believe what's European and American is better than what's Indian. If you didn't speak impeccable English and had an accent, you were somehow lesser than. That's where the self-loathing began. When those feelings would arise, I would dismiss them. But on this Breaking Bias journey, I realized this is inside of me. This is why I went by the name Andy and didn't tell people that I was Hindu and had a pantheon of deities I deeply revered. I was afraid of what they would think of me. I've seen this happen quite often in subordinated communities. An African colleague who isn't Christian or Muslim, but animist, as were most Africans before colonialism, feels incredibly alone in black spaces when he talks about his faith. That's the nature of neurocolonization, which is pervasive around the world. KB, I'm still thinking on what you said about being gaslit. I went to get my blood drawn recently, and as I approached the line, a white woman asked, "Are we waiting for you?" Wow. KB, I said, "I don't think so." She assumed I was the technician. Then she left, I think from shame. Later, a friend questioned my interpretation. First of all, I'm sorry that happened to you. Those types of experiences led me to my ledge. I learned the way I look at this now from the Buddhist tradition. When someone says something harmful, think of them as giving you presents. Then think of not accepting those presents. It's an invitation, if it triggers me, to heal that wound. There's something inside me that believes that I'm less than. There's little I can do to change people, but I can change how I respond. It becomes, oh, that person doesn't want to do their work. That's on them. KB, I'm reminded of an image I saw after the presidential election of black women atop a roof, sipping tea and watching the world burn. They're saying, you take care of this. I'm living my life. At this moment, I believe the antidote is self-compassion. Those subjected to implicit bias need to double down on loving kindness for the person inside who continues to feel harmed. This is where stereotypes replacement is also really helpful. Build up mental models of humans who did this successfully, like Toni Morrison, Nelson Mandela, Gandhi, Aung San Suu Kyi, and St. Francis. These are small tests for what I think of as keeping our eyes on the prize, which is liberation, creating a world where all of us belong in the fullness of our being. For now, let's start with being right here. KB, well, I'm glad you're right here and didn't fall forward. Me too. Life has been real fun since then. All the things I would have missed. Anugupta J.D. is an educator, human rights lawyer, scientist, meditation teacher, and the founder and CEO of Be More, with Anu, an online learning company that trains professionals to advance inclusion and wellness by breaking bias. He is the author of the 2024 book, Breaking Bias. Visit Be More with Anu, and that's all one word, BEMOREWITHANU.com. We pause for a moment to remind you that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, 24 hours of programming from over 300 publications, and you're currently listening to the Philosopher Program with your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info and audio/on demand. We return now to Mike Dooley's Channeled Messages from Deep Space, Wisdom for a Changing World. And this is with Tracy Farquhar. In last week, we had started part one, Life on Brahoshka. They've answered several questions for us. And the last question was about how have you most significantly changed due to your civilization's evolution? And Mike asks now, how have these lessons shown up outwardly, physically, in your world? In the days before we transcended, the struggles inherent in the material world, our system suffered many of the same complications that plague your planet. War, disease, crime, and institutional corruption ran rampant, and the future of our system appeared extremely bleak for quite a long while. In the meantime, there were many advances made in the scientific study of the correlation between the mind and the soul, and between the intellect and the consciousness, which, it was discovered, is quite separate from thought. It was proven that consciousness, the spirit, the soul, were quite unique energetic components of life, and that these elements were able to be separated from the physical body and the mind in such a way that they could travel through space and time without affecting the existence of the physical life left behind. And so, too, is there another realm of your consciousness that is living a quite different type of life in another dimensional space? This life feels safe and seems just as real as your waking life does. And in fact, it is just as real, and that is the way you experience it. But you should also have noticed that in your nighttime dream state, your dream experiences also feel just as real and tangible as your waking experiences. So the question could be, which of my life experiences are real and which are not? Our contention is that they are all real, as they all affect your psyche and create the best atmosphere for learning, growth, and ascension. The lives that we continue to experience share some characteristics with the lives you experience here on Earth, although many of the day-to-day stresses and worries no longer plague us. We have eliminated the need for currency exchange as a means of survival, and so there are no longer issues of poverty and crime related to it. This has become the single most freeing transformation in our world. In our current system, those who are expressing their talents and skills in various ways are encouraged to share these activities with those who need their services for the greater good. There is always an eventual trade-off of services and skills, so the cycle of energetic exchange is never lopsided. What is received will eventually be given, and so the need for a physical manifestation of that energy is merely symbolic and unnecessary. If one performs a large service for another, sometimes gifts will be exchanged in the form of handmade implements and adornments. The elimination of uneven distribution of wealth, the free expression of compassion for all beings, and the unlimited resources of talented individuals who are no longer manipulated by greed have caused exponential growth in the research and development fields and have created a virtual elimination of high-stress living. We've also eliminated the need for political hierarchy and oligarchy, and there's a system in place now which means we no longer need to have a single ruler or leader. In this system, many groups combine to monitor the systems in place with the intention of looking for ways to improve and expand how we offer services and training to the general public. A mandatory, one-size-fits-all organized educational system does not exist anymore in our world, but because education is seen as a life-sustaining asset, new and varied systems now exist for which attendance is voluntary, yet it is universally available to all, and it's seen as quite valuable. How would you value the time of an author, someone like Tracy or me? What if someone writes a book that sells a million copies? Or what about a book that takes a year to write but is not a commercial success? How is the author able to recoup the energy expended? Will the author be discouraged from writing in the future? When it comes to the compensation for creative works such as books, music, works of art, and other items that have a highly subjective sense of value, the issue of compensation is a bit more complicated, but what we have found is that since the value of these items is being determined directly by those who purchase them and not by any other entity, there's often a greater feeling of fairness in the compensation of time and energy expended. What we mean is that in your systems, as they stand, a book's success, for example, is often determined by the entities that publish and market it, and not necessarily on its merit. Many creative works that are created with great skill are overlooked simply because they're not brought to the public's attention with highly exclusive forms of marketing that may not be easily accessible to the artists producing them. And so we would like to stress that some of the greatest minds and talents can be found in the least examined walks of life, undiscovered by the general public. This does not in any way mean that their work is less valuable. It simply means that those in power have not placed that value upon it. In our culture, written works are not generally mass-produced as they are in yours. Instead, we have institutions, much like your lending libraries, where written works may be circulated among the public, with additional copies produced based on the work's popularity. Artwork may be acquired by members of the public, but there are also institutions similar to your museums and galleries where certain works may be displayed and viewed. Compensation for these works is not entirely based on the number of people who purchase or acquire the works. Rather, there's a system whereby artists of all types are supported in their endeavors with housing, food, and other requirements for living in a sort of colony where they're provided with the materials they need to create within their craft and live a comfortable life. When the works of a particular artist become in high demand, these living arrangements are extended for as long as the artist chooses to produce. If the works do not prove to be popular or in demand among the general public, the artist will be encouraged to pursue some other form of employment while still producing their creative works for the sheer joy of it. While we acknowledge that not all forms of artistic expression will be performed with the degree of skill and care needed to appeal to the discernment of the public, we will always support the production of creative works simply for the spiritual expansion of the artist and the joy that the creative act brings to their energy. We will provide support for those whose works exhibit the degree of skill and mastery needed to enhance the lives of those who enjoy it. And we will assist those whose works are not as popular to find other forms of employment while still producing that which brings them joy. What are the top five challenges faced by your society? 1. Elder care. Our lives extend for the equivalent of 400 of your years or more, and while we generally have good health, there are the issues surrounding an aging population that are similar to those you experience in your society. There's a large population of elderly among us now who need care and attention, and there's simply aren't enough institutions in place to care for them. Therefore, many families have taken in their elder relatives and friends to ensure that they're receiving the care they need. Some of these elders not only have challenges with their health and cognizance, they're from an older generation who resisted the changes we instigated, and so some of them are quite bitter and resentful, even though they can see the benefits of the changes that have occurred. This is causing a bit of stress and discontent among the households that have taken them in. We're currently working on the construction of facilities for this population, but it is not easy, as the inhabitable space on our planet is limited, and the space needed for this type of construction is difficult to find. 2. Food scarcity. Because of the rather harsh conditions on our planet, there are restrictions on the plant material that is able to grow, and the space in which we're able to propagate it is limited. There have been some breakthroughs in botanical research that have produced new growing methods and new types of plants, but there's some controversy over the use of some of these plants, as there are those who believe they're not natural. This is similar to the issue you're facing with genetically modified plants in your world. Research is ongoing, however, and so far, we've been able to maintain a healthy supply of foodstuff, and we continue to perfect the growing process. 3. Manufacturing goods. As we are restricted in our movement around the planet at certain times, this places limitations on how we manufacture and transport goods. While we value handcrafting more now than was previously the case, there are some items that benefit from rapid manufacture, and so we do have some types of automated systems similar to your factories, but they cannot be quite as large, and they will be restrictive in nature. We do not have as wide a diversity of materials available on our planet as you do. This also limits what we have to work with in the manufacture of items needed for everyday living. The benefit to this is that we have had to become extremely resourceful in the ways we use the available materials, but it does sometimes limit what we're able to accomplish in the manufacture of goods. 4. Law enforcement. While we have been experiencing one of the most peaceful eras in our history, there's still a need for peace officers to uphold the law and maintain order. There are some issues that arise from this need, which are somewhat similar to the issues you experience on your planet. While we do not have many issues involving violence, we do experience the occasional theft or disturbance that requires the intervention of law enforcement. We're continuing to work toward a culture that is free from violence, but at the present time, we do experience certain expressions of anger or reactions to perceived slights that can lead to emotional outbursts and worse. The issues arise here when the officers become overwhelmed with the sense of power and either abuse that power or withdraw from it. 5. Damage done to the planet. Before we were able to shift our consciousness into one that honored our planet and the land that we live upon, there were some forms of industry that were doing quite a bit of harm to the structure of the planet through mining, experimenting on the soil, and blasting through sedimentary rock in search of resources. While multiple efforts are continuing to be made to heal some of this damage, it is clear that some of it is irreversible at this time. There are areas of instability in the land as a result of some of these destructive practices, which again places limitations on the areas of our planet that are habitable and safe. We're confident, however, that we will continue to heal from these catastrophes. What are the top 10 ways your society differs from ours? We are happy to compile a list for you. Understand that the comparison is by no means meant to offer criticism or judgment of the systems currently in place within the structure of your culture. It is merely to offer an alternative perspective. This is what we hope to achieve through these communications, a sense that there are other methods of living that can create more balance, cooperation, and heart-centered living. It is our hope that our examples will motivate you to find your own. 1. Monetary exchange. As we've stated, we do not operate within the structure of a monetary exchange for goods or services. Once we identified that the use of currency had created a huge sense of inequity and materialism in our culture, we made it a priority to devise other systems that created a more balanced method of energetic exchange. We identified the true nature of currency as a symbol of exchange rather than a method of material gain. So we were able to find other methods of exchange that do not as greatly affect a class structure, favoring those who have the means to accumulate wealth over those who do not. A simplified explanation of our current system is one in which each individual is able to focus on their strengths, talents, and gifts in order to provide goods and services to fulfill the needs of the community. There are some who work in communion with others, and some who are more solitary, just as in your society. For instance, if one is drawn to running a storefront that provides a certain type of goods, there will be a system of checks and balances kept that records the goods taken. Those who take the goods will be beholden to provide their own merchandise or services in exchange. This is not always a direct exchange, however, as these types of institutions are usually managed by a group cooperative, and so the exchange can occur among any members of that cooperative. There's a great deal of trust built into this system. We have found that the vast majority of individuals honor it and gladly maintain the balance of exchange without having to earn and spend any type of currency. There are also systems in place to care for those who are unable to work for whatever reason. However, we find that more people are motivated to find some sort of occupational activity, no matter how limited they are, which somehow contributes to the well-being of the society. 2. Marriage and relationships. Our culture does not have the ritual of marriage as part of the family structure. As a community-based society, family structures can be extensive and include those who are not related by birth, but are those with whom we choose to share our lives and sometimes our homes. While there are those who choose to have monogamous relationships, it is not the only cultural standard, and there are some who choose a less structured form of relationship, just as there are in your culture. We do not have the same standards regarding sexual behavior, as it is not viewed in quite the same way in our culture. So many of what you may view as moral standards simply do not exist in our culture, and we operate quite well within this system. Acts of physical affection are not limited to sexuality, and so there's less of a sense of having all needs met by one partner or one spouse, and instead there is less of a formally structured foundation in the area of relationships. This does not mean that we're not respectful and sensitive to the emotional and physical desires of others. It simply means there are fewer expectations on romantic relationships as a major source of stability and happiness. Love is not reserved only for those to whom we are bound in a sense of formal ritual. It is something we express more freely, but not necessarily in a sexual way. While there is a sexual element to relationships, and of course to the act of procreation, it is not emphasized quite so much in our culture as the only means of showing affection, and it is not regulated quite so much by our standards of cultural behavior. It exists more as a natural form of self-expression, which, while still being a private act, does not have the underlying sense of sinfulness attached to it, and therefore does not have industries, businesses, and exploitation attached to it. We would like you to consider how a shift in this area may create huge changes in your own world's culture. 3. Health. Since we do not have a monetary system of exchange, the areas of health and wellness are not structured as profit-making businesses. As such, our emphasis is more on the wellness aspects of health rather than an industry of pharmaceuticals. Those who have serious issues of health are cared for and supported nutritionally in such a way that the balance is brought back to the body so that it is in the best energetic environment to heal itself. While we will use certain forms of plant-based medicines to help balance the body's systems, alleviate pain, and discourage the growth of foreign invaders to the body, we do not have the wide range of symptom relievers available in your culture, as we feel that is the symptoms that can help to identify what the body needs to support its healing. In other words, we do what we can to make the individual comfortable, and we provide care that involves meeting nutritional needs that will strengthen the physical systems so that they can heal. As we have eliminated a lot of the toxins that cause many of the forms of disease we had previously been experiencing, we've had a huge decline in health problems among our civilization, and as the levels of stress in our daily lives has diminished, so have stress-related illnesses. This does not mean that we do not experience illness. It simply means that we no longer have the need to create an industry structured on sickness. And as such, there's a cultural system now that is based on maintaining wellness. We have found that this has created an environment of fewer incurable diseases, less of a need for medical or medicinal intervention, and longer lifespans. There has also been a decline of illness among the elderly, and many continue to live quite robust lives until they're ready to transition forward. We're pleased to see a gradual shift in attitude toward health and wellness in your own culture, although there's still much work to be done in the areas of integrating forms of energetic health with physical health and moving away from a system of profit-based pharmaceuticals. 4. Political structure. The fundamental structure of leadership based on hierarchy, status, and wealth was one of the main components of our society's near collapse. As these systems of leadership began to crumble and decisions became more based on greed and gain rather than the common good, the entire structure of society collapsed, and we were forced to create an entirely different structure that would rise up against much opposition and fear. We've seen similar scenarios played out in the history of your world's culture, and we're aware of how the collapse of these systems has often resulted in great acts of violence and suffering for those who were dwelling within those structures. It is quite remarkable that your culture has recovered time and time again from these disasters, and we see this as evidence that there's a core foundation of those who see the truth and who really do have the common good as the foundation of leadership. Power is quite a challenging aspect of leadership, as it activates the ego in such a way that it begins to use fear as its motivating force. As such, we have developed a more even distribution of power that is not focused on one person's ability to make decisions that affect many, but rather is a true commonwealth led by those who have demonstrated their abilities to create change that is in the highest good of all, and not just for self-serving needs. This type of communal structure is not party-based, nor is it based on votes or family lineage, but rather on a demonstrated ability to have foresight, intelligence, intuition, and compassion as the basis for their decision-making in all areas of their lives. Individuals can be nominated or apply for these positions, and a code of standards is followed to choose those who are best suited to these positions. These officials are not seen as status symbols or high-ranking individuals. Rather, they're seen as citizens with extraordinary intuitive gifts to understand what is needed and creative gifts to usher in needed change. Without a monetary system, which can be the foundation for greed, these officials are more likely to stay true to their intentions and loyal to the individuals they serve. And as there is an equal distribution of this power, it is unlikely that one will be guided by the self-serving ego. 5. Education. Our structure of early education has become much more relaxed and less rigid than it once was, which allows for more freedom of expression, individual growth, and blossoming of spirit. We discovered that when forced into a structure that treated all as one standard, without leaving allowances for different styles of learning and different personalities, there was a resistance to learning and a rebellion against that forced standard of behavior. As we began to allow more free time for movement, creative expression, and unstructured play and discussion, the students responded in a much more positive way as their individual characteristics were honored and their need for physical movement and an open forum for free expression were respected. We found that with less pressure and structure, students were more prone to a better learning experience, and their eagerness to experiment with new ways of thinking through a hands-on approach was remarkable. The secondary educational system was completely destructured into more of a trade school type of institution, which allows a broad scope of experience and few requirements. Those who wish to learn a particular trade can concentrate solely on the training that is geared to those skills, and those who wish to experience a broader scope of learning can pursue this with impunity. Learning is encouraged throughout the life of an individual, and so there are students of all ages to be found in these schools, many of whom are pursuing education simply for the enrichment of their lives and for the experience of expanding their minds. There are few to no expectations for secondary education. Students are encouraged to seek out that which emphasizes their own unique skills and talents and to pursue different paths throughout their lives for a rich and varied experience. And again, without the binding goal of profit and income, these schools can be more focused on their main intention and do not need to sell their services, and students do not have the pressure of debt to interfere with the enjoyment of the experience. 6. Spirituality and religion. While we never had the same type of religious structure that is prevalent in your society, we did at one time have some structures of belief that were more readily accepted than others, leaving those who practiced outside of those structures to feel left out or judged. There were those who practiced a more spiritually based type of belief system, and those who adhered to a more standard practice of ritual and belief with little scope between them. The numbers who practiced the more structured belief system began to dwindle as our societal structures gave more respect to the individual and placed a greater emphasis on cooperation. Within these new structures came a need for a type of spirituality that honored the individual rather than punished it and created a more supportive framework of the community without judgment or a sense of sinfulness. Thus, we now have a more spiritually based society with many levels of belief, all based on the idea of rejoicing in a sense of gratitude, honoring the divine spirit, acknowledging the spirit that lies within, and celebrating the transition of this spirit upon the death of the body. Not everyone practices ritual or worship, and there's no sense of a right or wrong way to practice spirituality within this structure. Similar to the way the educational system was changed, the freedom of expression in the spiritual community has caused a peaceful coexistence which no longer judges or forces those who practice into certain structures of ritual. Gatherings are held for those who wish to express their love for the Creator in that way, and solitary practice is found among those who feel more comfortable with that. Some do not participate in any structure of belief, and some find a daily practice of ritual to be soothing and beneficial to their state of mind. All are welcome to express this sense of themselves in any way that suits them, and there is no label delineation among these forms of spiritual expression. 7. Food and nutrition. As we have previously stated, our nutritional sources are not as varied as yours. However, we find that with some creativity, we are able to experience a diverse and interesting diet that has the density of nutrition needed to survive the harsh conditions of our environment. There was never a time in our world when we had the systems of manufacture that we currently see in your world, although there are processing areas for different foods that require it. We've always had to be conscious of maintaining a nutritional diet, and so we've not experienced some of the issues your world has encountered with the prevalence of less nutritional and habit-forming foods, and there are no standards of beauty that emphasize a certain body structure or weight. However, in the changing structures of our society, we found new ways of processing the limited resources we have, which preserve the spaces in which these things are grown and cultivated, and increased production through more careful harvesting and more strategic farming. We have also developed some new species of food material that is more nutritionally dense and covers a wider range of needs molecularly. This has not required genetic engineering, however. Instead, it involved a propagation of a current species of plant that was once considered inedible in such a way that allowed it to be ground into an edible form with the application of heat to dry and crush it. We've also discovered some other flowering plants that yield a variety of edible material that can be compared to your fruits. These additions to our diet have added a nutritional source that is helping to increase the health of our population, and the awareness of the need for a rich and varied diet has grown with education and the increased availability of products. Again, without the profit margin placed on the manufacture of food, more emphasis can be placed on its nutritional value rather than its habit-forming appeal. 8. Science and technology. Once again, this is an area that has benefited from a relaxing of standards and a broadening of scope, which has stretched to include the research of previously uncharted territory in the areas of scientific exploration. Once scientists were able to cross the line from pure scientific inquiry to include the research of energetic spirit, the science of thought, and the power of the energetic realms, everything we had previously believed to be true within the rigid structure of scientific inquiry changed. We find many similarities in this structure with your own, and so this is an area where we see a great deal of scope for expansion and change. Once the areas of research began to expand beyond that which was once deemed possible, new systems were found that could be harnessed for things that were previously only dreamed of. New technologies that were once thought impossible were born from the study of energy and from the exploration of the energetic fields of deep space. These methods of exploration were only possible through the energetic expansion of the individual spirit being. And so, just as we're able to communicate with you through this energetic transference, there were amazing things discovered about the universe through the same type of exploration. Removing the physical aspects of space exploration has eliminated the need for physical transport and the time and space constraints inherent with that. It has also opened up the fields of molecular and atomic exploration within the physical structures of our planet and our own bodies, which was never even thought of previously. The power of the mind and spirit is still being discovered in all its varied nuances and complexities, and it is a field of research that is ever expanding in its scope. We come now to the end of our program. As always, I wish you a beautiful, joyous, and peaceful new week, and look forward to being with you next time on our Philosopher program.